Good evening and welcome. This is 42 Minutes, the show that considers the answers to the question of life, the universe, and everything. I am Douglas Bowles, and tonight, Sunday, December 16th, we have a special guest.
Yes, we do. Hello, my name is William Morgan, and tonight we will be speaking with the king of media monarchy, James Evan Pilato, the proprietor of such independent media sites such as New World Next Week, Food World Order, Pump Up the Volume, one of my personal favorites, and so much more. All of which can be found at MediaMonarchy.com. Most recently, however, James has become a producer on the Ground Zero program with Clyde Lewis, which is nationally syndicated and doing actually really well, isn't it, James?
It really is. Each time we look at the numbers, it's better than it was before. Yeah, there are a ton of cities that we're number one in.
And you guys just got opened up to much more or many more cities, right? If I
I think the way it all started was that when Ground Zero got syndicated, that's what created the job for me that I applied for. And it was basically that was when the show was going national. So I think through what's basically been kind of the trial period for these last few months is where stations are deciding, yes, we want to continue to play it. Oh, and it's such a hit, we basically have 3 national hours available for syndication. Some cities only carry 1. So, of course, when people call and complain and say, you know, our city only carries 1 hour, it's like, well, you have to call them and say, you know, I want more Ground Zero. But, yeah, it's amazing.
Well, what has it done for your workload?
Well, I mean, essentially, I knew as soon as I got the job that I was going to have to put my weekly Media Monarchy podcast and it was, you know, recorded live radio show, would have to put it on indefinite hiatus. There was just no way on earth I could do all of those things, because essentially Ground Zero is 5 hours Monday through Friday.
That's incredible.
So a ton of content, and most of it all rests on the fact that Clyde is I think a likable, you know, on-air personality, and this is the world of commercial talk radio, so not a world I've exactly been in before. I've always just tried to just do, you know, my passion and my media on my own, and so it never really had any strings attached or any dollar signs attached to it. And I've always generally had a some kind of food job that paid my bills and fed me. So I mean, for the better part of my life, I'd pretty much either, you know, waited tables or bartended or worked in a restaurant, or here in Portland, I'd worked at a cool, you know, independent grocery store and did the food thing so that then I could do my media passion thing, like, you know, like I said, on my own. So Media Monarchy never had any, you know, dollar signs attached to it, other than when I had grown enough to where I could kind of ask for donations. So it's been a weird mix. And I mean, really, a lot of it all happened. And yesterday was actually my 5th month anniversary. Oh, wow. Of smoking cigarettes. Because long story short, when I quit smoking cigarettes, I lost it. And I was a anxiety attack. I mean, I'm 35. I had essentially smoked for 17 years, half my life, basically. So when I quit, I was a basket case. And I ended up having to change a lot of things, not only with, you know, just health and diet and habit. But I found myself at the grocery store thinking, really, dude, stocking shelves? Like, I know I'm meant for more than this. I've got a degree that says I know how to do radio. So I look online out of just kind of frustration at the radio station that Clyde did his show for. Because I was a fan of Ground Zero. I listened to it. Right. And saw that they needed a producer because the show was going national. And it was really just the change, I think, that I needed. And it went from basically seeing the ad to emailing Clyde to having the program director call me to having an interview, all in just a matter of days that essentially, you know, changed a lot around.
Was Clyde familiar with you?
He and I had both worked together. We had both been on each other's shows. I had had him on the podcast, and he had had me as a guest on his show when it was still, you know, not syndicated nationally, when it was just the Portland, Oregon show.
For him, then, it must have been like a no-brainer, right? He must have saw your name and been like, are you shitting me?
So I think so, because when I saw the listing online, I immediately wrote him, was like, man, should I apply for this, or do you guys already have someone and you just had to post this because of the legalities of it? He was like, no, by all means. So, yeah, and I think when I got the gig, and I think I got the gig because Clyde was able to say, I want James, because I know they were interviewing other people, but I had it over them and said this in the interview. It was like, they don't know Clyde, though. They don't know the show. They don't, like, I kind of do this already content-wise, so I can learn the ins and outs of commercial radio, but you couldn't teach them what, you know, is essentially years of years and years of practice and research and doing this on my own. So I think when I showed them Media Monarchy, in a way, I kind of acted as my own resume to basically go to MediaMonarchy.com. Everything you see there, I totally built myself.
Yeah, and you have an influence, obviously, on the way the show runs. I mean, just this Friday, you guys had one of your heroes, if I would, one of your sync heroes, I should say, Lauren Coleman, actually. Uh-huh. I mean, that was it's interesting because you wanted to interview Lauren Coleman for so very long, right?
The funny part about doing Ground Zero, and I've said this a few times, that the amazing thing that happens is when you write people and say, hi, I'm the producer of a nationally syndicated talk show, damn if they don't call and write you back.
It's like the secret of propaganda. It's like, this person knows what they're talking about. But we all have that, like, natural turnoff to weirdos or trolls on the internet. So if you, like, send something out and people don't know who you are, they kind of ignore you. Uh-huh. But you come with – I mean, Clyde's cool, man. I like listening to Clyde. It's his energy that keeps it so engaging. And he's not scared to argue at all.
No, and that – I mean, to me, not being – you know, my favorite part of it. I'm the one now that can be on the other side of the glass just being like, come on, just cut this dude off. Like, you should move on.
call-in aspect, yeah.
The call-in, which was never really, it's never been something I've done in you know, in Media Monarchy. But ultimately, I love it. It's a blast. I mean, I have a desk. You know, I have things I've never had before as a job. The weird flip is that, you know, like I said, I used to have, you know, some kind of food related job that I was up on my feet and moving and grooving all day, you know, at a grocery store or restaurant, you're up and down and lifting and carrying and, you know, all around. And then I could go home and sit on my butt and do Media Monarchy. But now that sort of, the passion has become the job. It's made the flip turn around to where now my home life has to be more food and exercise related.
There's no time for hobby, huh?
Well, I mean, my big hobby and other passion, and you, thank you for mentioning Pump Up the Volume in the intro there. What I've basically been able to lean back on, having put Media Monarchy on hiatus, that is, you know, the weekly podcast, which is the thing people knew it from. You know, it's easy, you can post up and repost up, you know, articles and blog and all that stuff, but I think it's the podcast, it's the kind of original content that really makes things happen. And that's always, you know, what makes Corbett so amazing, is, you know, all his stuff is all, it's all original content. He doesn't, you know, repost articles, and I mean, it's about.
It's insane. It's insane.
And so that was one of my questions, both for both shows. Is so you both are basically news producers. You're going out and creating original news stories. I'm wondering what kind of sources are you using.
So you mean for New World Next Week with Corbett, or working on Ground Zero?
With Corbett and what you did with Media Monarchy. You know, so as like you're not using.
He's a news hound, or you just got your you got your nose in the print, right?
I've you know, kind of subscribed to a million, you know, RSS feeds and just kind of look at news all around, whether that's in the Oregonian and the local, you know, free Portland papers and what's online, and just kind of take in as. And I've always been like that. I think a lot of it sources back to, and I talked to my mom earlier on the phone today, and it's Sunday. You should, you know, always call your mom, especially when they're 3,000 miles away. That's what's hard about being out on the West Coast. Most of my family's on the East Coast. But when you look at your life and you look back at yourself as a kid, and I can look back at myself as a kid and see that from a pretty early age, I was playing records, and especially like the storybook records, you know, when you hear the sound, turn the page.
Yeah.
Those, and playing with tapes and learning that, oh, when you put a little piece of tape over this, you know, hole on the cassette tape, you can tape over it and you could start to screw with stuff that way. And I remember, you know, taping the audio off of TV shows. I've messed with and remixed and just swam in media essentially all my life. So now when I look at my life now, I go, oh, it kind of makes sense that I'm still into doing this. And I went to the record store today, and that's where we were hearing Dave Brubeck on vinyl. That's what was playing through my system here a little bit ago, because Dave Brubeck, jazz legend, passed away last week or even the week before now. And I realized, oh, I don't have any Dave Brubeck. Putting Media Monarchy on hiatus has let me lean more on Pump Up the Volume, the music podcast that I do. That's basically just brand new music. It's about an hour every week. It's kind of a pre-recorded thing that I put together, because again, just with the timing of it all, I just kind of record some voice tracks and put it all together. But if you're a new music fan, it's got amazing new music, you know, pretty much every week, tons of stuff that I get turned on to. That's how I try and stay, you know, kind of up to date. And then continuing to do New World Next Week with Corbett, where, I mean, my relationship with James Corbett goes now, you know, back several years, where I don't know who wrote who first, but it was still in the sort of earlier days of podcasting. And it was pretty much at the kind of somewhat peak of what would, you know, 9/11 truth. It would have, you know, this would be in, you know, 2006 and 7. Mm-hmm. One of us wrote the other and said, you know, hey, man, like your work, you know, keep it up. And it kind of, you know, we kept in touch with each other. And it was only when he started to do more, when he kind of incorporated video work, he had me for like a video interview, which I think at the time we were talking about what was a new venture for me. And that was Food World Order, like that would just cover, you know, food health environment. And what, I don't know, again, it's all kind of lost time as to who came up with. But, you know, we just had the idea of let's do just a new show, a simple thing where at the time YouTube would only let you upload 10 minutes. So those earliest New World Next Weeks are actually only 10 minutes long. And then whenever YouTube let you 15 minutes, that's when they kind of expanded to 15 minutes. James Corbett's YouTube account finally became unlocked, and now he has unlimited upload time. That's why last week's New World Next Week is actually the longest one we had ever done.
I noticed that. That's,
and I, in a way, sort of like, oh, I kind of don't like removing the time constriction, because for me, the way I've always worked, that's why I've always liked live radio. That's why I've always, or you know, I kind of come from a theater background. I like the idea that when the clock strikes, you're on, because I know it's easy to procrastinate. And so having a live deadline kind of makes it happen. And I just like to work within, you know, a genre and a framework. But James and I basically collaborate on stories. When it's either, you know, the day before, I'll send him a few headlines and he'll send me a few headlines, and we'll basically go back and forth a couple of times, basically go, yeah, I like that one and that one, but can we switch, you know, this one out for maybe this other, you know, kind of collaborate back and forth. Sometimes, you know, one of us is more, you know, on our game, or one is more busy, so the other brings to the table, like here, I've got, you know, what I think makes a good, you know, mix of stories. But he edits and does that all on his end. So I, you know, I take no credit for any video audio production at all.
Man. So, I got to ask you this, because we ask most everyone that we've talked to, what was it about synchromysticism that made your radar go off? I mean, can you pinpoint the time? Because I mean, it's a hard thing to understand. It's a hard thing to grasp for the normal. It's easy to write off for a normal individual, and even I, it took a while for it to be like, you know, sitting there. Oh shit! Like there's something to this. I mean, do you remember that point in your awakening, if you would?
I don't know. I guess I feel like I heard, because there was a point where, and to go back, I was the music director at my college radio station before I moved to Portland, Oregon. And I had and moving to Portland, Oregon pretty much sets the start of media monarchy in a way that it was sort of the end of playing with bands and doing theatrical sound design and doing college radio and shifting into more of the world of doing alternative news, you know, talk casting 9/11 truth stuff.
And is that your inception into 9/11 truth about 2005 or?
No, I had kind of
2006?
Discovered earlier back in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is my college town where I went to school and where I was the music director at WSHC. I had started to mix in 9/11 truth stuff on the radio late night because it was something that I had gotten into, and this would be, you know, 2003.
Wow, really?
Because I mean, it was my own, and I pretty much say this in any, you know, new place I'm kind of being interviewed or appearing or talking or whatever. My whole awakening I can trace back to being the media junkie that I referred to always being, that at the point when I finally had my own computer, so this, you know, or at least a computer at my disposal, and the internet had become, you know, a usable thing, it was my own curiosity. It was like, ooh, what's the video of the plane hitting the Pentagon look like? And you type that in and you discover, oh, we don't know what that looks like. They've never released anything. And that was before, you know, any of the frames, any footage had ever really been released. So that was my launching into 9/11 truth. But to talk about that publicly in 2003 wasn't all that cool. It wasn't that acceptable thing. So it was kind of something I quietly researched on my own. And that point too was when downloading, and it was, you were able to kind of download and start to stream these documentaries that were coming out. Of course, you immediately find Alex Jones at that time, and so that's a huge thing for me. And to this day, I mean, I was a huge influence on Alex Jones, famous the show constantly. I think gets to the heart of what people, you get kind of addicted to it. And I still stand by saying that Alex Jones, nothing else, turned on a whole bunch of to, because the technology and everything also facilitating.
This is 42 minutes. We're up just under 20 minutes in, and we're speaking with James Colasso about sync.
Testing.
Check 1, 2.
Douglas?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, go for it.
So where did you lose me? I think I was.
Well, so you were talking about your inception into, or not inception, but maybe initiation into 9/11 truth, and a name that I found associated with you on one of your ancillary sites, Netflix.
Navigating Netflix.
Richard Grove.
Yes.
That's interesting because actually I discovered his 9/11 synchronicity podcast way back. And those were some really tight things back
in
the day.
And that for me was the point when I think I stopped listening to Alex Jones so much. I was basically going to say I worked in the graveyard shift at the grocery store that I worked at here in Portland for the first 2 years I worked there. And I needed my eyes and my hands for that job because the store was closed. I listened to tons of podcasts. I was able to pretty much listen to every kind of, you know, daily and weekly show because you had 8 hours a night to do it, essentially. But yeah, I wrote to Richard early on, you know, when it was still, you know, single digit early episodes from 9/11 synchronicity, and I think was an early supporter. So he and I, you know, have been connected again for quite some time. As far as for synchro mysticism, I think, you know, once the years started to go by away from 9/11, you start to realize, oh, it can't just be about 9/11. And I even noticed at the time folks whose work I liked kind of dropped out of the scene, as it were. Because I remember there was a dude named Daniel Abramson who appeared with Webster Tarpley a bunch, and he ran a news site called False Flag News. Mm-hmm. That I found really kind of, you know, eye-opening, because that was when you start to go, oh, it is all of these drills, it is all these private contractors. But folks like Greg Nixon, who also ran a site that kind of dedicated, you know, study of the drills and the private military contractors, a lot of those dudes at some point in mid-2000s basically were like, kind of hung it up and basically said, you know, 9/11 truth, you know, is as big as it's going to be. And ultimately, I don't think it matters. We're not going to find it out. And they've already moved on to their next scam. And I think it's going to be a financial scam. And then 2008 came. It was like, oh, damn, they were completely right. 9/11 truth, you know, reached a certain point, and the elites had already moved off to some other, you know, to their next scam. And people correctly called it. It was going to be the financial scam. It almost gets to the point for me now where I feel like, and like I said, so much has kind of changed for me in the last few months, that in a week that we've seen with the shooting here in Clackamas, Oregon, which we were talking before the show, reminded me almost like on 9/11, that Clackamas was the first tower being hit that caught everybody's attention and everybody's focused on it. And then the second tower was the Connecticut shooting, and it just destroyed everyone. And that's the way the media is able to play this. It's fascinating being in a newsroom now, because the radio station that I work for, of course, has the country station and the pop station and the alternative station and the talk station. So seeing a newsroom have to sort of deal with when something like that happened, you know, so close to home, and then 3 days later have it happen, you know, again on the other side of the country, but it was even such a bigger impact because, of course, it was, you know, a much more, you know, bloody.
Little children. Yeah, I think it's the children is like the new factor in this one.
But to me, man, you know, it almost makes me at this point just like, man, I almost don't even want to. I feel like I now look at those guys I was referring to, like Daniel Abramson and Greg Nixon, who at some point were just like, I can't do this anymore. I've done the amazing, you know, I've done the hardest work as I can. But yeah, it's just, it makes me almost not even want to try and go into, you know, solving this latest mystery. Because you've solved several of them, you know, kind of what the deal is. I find myself in a way kind of retreating more into music, which has always been my first love. I think that's what I find myself.
I gotta thank you, man. I gotta thank you for Toussaint Morrison. It was Toussaint Morrison is like the only thing that I've been listening to for like 3, maybe 4 months. It's the only, you know, back in the 90s and stuff, even earlier than that, of course, but it's pretty much the 90s, maybe. Yeah, it was about 1997 where you could play an album for like 3 months straight. Do you know, you get what I'm saying? That stuff doesn't happen anymore.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to find.
I picked up Toussaint off of Pump Up the Volume. We use Pump Up the Volume to go looking for new music for our green rooms here.
Oh, awesome.
So yeah, I enjoy it because, you know, you listen to it and it will be eclectic. It will have all kinds of music in it. And you're like, oh, I like this. And then you can go onto the site and find out more about that specific person.
And that to me has always been what I mean, the internet as the tool for the thing that says, you know, this is a band or this is an author who, you know, aren't inaccessible, aren't unapproachable. There's some regular person who needs a little bit of dough to keep doing the work that they're doing. So the internet has really kind of facilitated. So it's so much fun to be able to do Pump Up the Volume and to sort of communicate with some of these bands through Twitter and through email. Because once you kind of mention them, they'll mention you and say, hey, thanks for... And it kind of grows that, you know, that community.
Would that be your advice to individuals who might be inspired by yourself? To just, I mean, get in contact with these people like you did with Corbett and like you did Grove.
That's the thing, yeah, and you and me. The way that I did a lot of work with some good friends back east, back in the college town, we essentially were in a band, but we always kind of found being in a band really limiting and confining because there were all kinds of other things that we wanted to do too. So once we figured out, like, oh, let's just start a record label and let that be the umbrella for the different things that we want to do under different names. So that way we can do this original, you know, music for this play, but we can also make our own crazy, you know, electronic ambient, you know, freeform jams that we do, and we'll put those out on our own. Or that's, I think, what, intentionally or not, what Media Monarchy is for me, and I think why I've created it and kind of kept it going. Media Monarchy, rather than just being some 9/11 truth that started in, you know, 2005, is now the umbrella for me to be able to have something that talks about food, health, and the environment with Food World Order, technology and space with cyberspace war, occult and religion stuff with holy hexes. You mentioned navigating Netflix. That one is a joint venture between Richard Grove and the whole Tragedy and Hope gang that we never quite took off. I'd love to see it kind of come back to life, but that was basically going to be, you know, a sort of movie review show. And then Pump Up the Volume, the music show. So basically making Media Monarchy that umbrella that can do all of those and cover all of those various things. The other thing that's been able to keep it all really going, so that I didn't have to just kind of close the gates when I got the ground zero job, which, you know, pays my bills, which means it has to be my job. Mm. That I have a handful of folks that work on some of those sites, at least, you know, well, I mean, it's, you know, New World Next Week is a collaboration with James Corbett. I've got three or four people that write and post for Food World Order. There's a couple of people that write and post for Cyberspace War and Holy Hexes. So those sites still have new content on them that I don't actually even have anything to do with. I mean, I'm the main editor of the sites, but I've basically kind of cultivated and kind of trained the handful of volunteers who have a passion for, you know, news and media as well. And kind of working with them gets it to the point where, you know, I can trust what Alan posts, you know, or I can trust what Brock or Adam or any of the folks, you know, who are awesome, who help out on all those aspects.
That's cool.
It was basically to create something that then I could almost turn over the keys to and say, you can do this too.
That's very noble of you, sir. But I have to ask, you know, it's funny that your last Media Monarchy, I think it was called There Is a Fire That Never Goes Out.
There's a Light That Never Goes Out.
Yeah, from the song, what's that, The Smiths. And but it was mostly about Princess Diana, correct?
It was, you know, and that was the thing about Media Monarchy that I sometimes found frustrating in a way, but it was the way the show kind of was, and it was the way I had gotten into the groove of making it, and it was the thing, I guess, that made it as popular as it was. I never really did thematic episodes. I always kind of looked at, you know, at Corbett's regular, you know, weekly podcast episodes, and kind of thought, gosh, I'd love to maybe do something like that, but that's so hard. Somebody was like, no, you just pick a subject and do some research on some certain areas. He was like, I think what you do is way harder because you're looking at everything from TV to politics and music and religion.
It was basically a radio show. I mean, you can go back and you can listen to them all, and there are topics, but there's like news, there's current, there's history, there's a little bit of music, there's all kinds of stuff thrown in.
And to me, that was the exciting part about doing it, is that, you know, Media Monarchy was the culmination of everything I saw in the previous week's zeitgeist, essentially. And there were times of even, you know, performing the show, you know, I would do it live and I wouldn't, you know, there was never really any edits to it or anything, unless it was, you know, a quality audio edit. But essentially, yeah, it was just what was going on in the moment. So having the last episode kind of be about Princess Diana was because that's what was kind of going on at the time. It was the 15th anniversary of her death, I believe, or some big anniversary of her death, and there were all these other things kind of floating back up in the...
Speaking of floaters, what do you think about this whole Kate being pregnant, twins, chaos?
that's always really fascinating. I even found myself doing the math at one point and be like, wait, does that mean I looking to see if the kid was going to be born on like May Day or something?
What's the zodiac sign? Like twins on Gemini or some crazy shit like that?
Something like that, you know. And I'm sure that's going to be something we'll get into more, you know, on Ground Zero. And that's, you know, I definitely had folks when I essentially said, hey, I'm going to work for, you know, Ground Zero and Clyde Lewis. They're like, oh, good, you know, you're going to go work for some, you know, fake-ass monster show. I look at the move that I made as any kind of sellout, because I essentially haven't sacrificed anything. I've never been told by anyone there, you know, the program director, anyone, oh, I don't think you should do that. You know, as long as you know, exist within the realm of, you know, FCC guidelines, I've never been told there's nothing, you know, that we can't do. And my job has basically, I think, been, you know,
it's the move of your career. I mean, like, your whole life has been such an eclectic potpourri that it just makes sense.
And when it all kind of came together, it was a no-brainer for me. I was like, there's no way that I could turn, you know, I usually through my life have kind of said no to a lot of things because it's not right for me, until that point when it's like, ah, okay now we can get along on that because it's not, you know, that much of a compromise, you know, to me and my ideals.
See, well, this brings up a topic. I mean, like, the thing is people probably would judge Ground Zero saying that it comes from this point of view or that point of view, as if there is aliens, Bigfoot or whatever the case. But I mean, on a personal level, what do you think about individuals like Rick Clay? I'm sure you're familiar with Rick Clay, correct?
Uh-huh.
And it was such a long time between when he died and when the actual London Olympics. Do you see him generating some kind of, like, the topics that we were talking about when the Olympics got here? Were largely due to Rick Clay. With the whole Zion, I mean, the Zion thing was Rick Clay, but that spread through everybody. Everybody was talking about that. So I'm wondering about the accuracy. Do you have some kind of personal – do you think that Rick Clay was wrong in any aspect or incorrect or
I guess I don't know enough of his work to say – what's accurate or inaccurate. I mean, I'm totally, you know, familiar with him, and definitely when, you know, thankfully Red Ice Radio did kind of a compilation as the London Olympics were approaching,
yes,
some of their previous interviews with him, and that kind of got me up to speed. But it was really Jake Kotze that I had first heard ever use the term synchromysticism. I don't know if he does lay claim to, you know, coining that term or who does or not, but he was the first person I heard kind of talk about it, and I don't remember if that was on.
Well, I'm just wondering if you think that there's some kind – I mean, because it's hard to pin down, you know, what is programming and sort of what is, like, just the natural mesh of, like, how human mythology works. Do you get what I'm saying? So I'm wondering if you draw a line where this is, like, some kind – like, you know, we asked Lauren Coleman when he was on 42 Minutes, you know, what causes this, and – and the most perfect answer in the world, he was like, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, he'll admit to you, he's not searching out programming or some, like, breadcrumbs left by government agencies. He's looking at something totally different. And I wonder, you know, what your view on, like, some kind of – do you have a radar of, like, is this bullshit? Is this true? Or is your own, like, mental – state just as eclectic as Ground Zero?
I definitely there are nights where, you know, the topics at Ground Zero, because ultimately at the end of the day it's Clyde Lewis's show, and that's why it's that's why it is what it is and as popular as it is, because it's his baby. I'm basically there to sort of, when he says, hey, I think, you know, we want to do a show on this or a show on that, I'm there to kind of help flesh it out and hopefully try and book a guest or any of those kind of things. But I can also definitely have my, you know, input as far as, you know, I think we should try and cover this, or I don't think you should say that, or, you know, hopefully, I guess, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what someone would say who'd been a listener to Ground Zero before me and after me. That sounds self-inflating, because it also, I came on with the national syndication of the show. But hopefully I think I've injected where, you know, Clyde would have never had anyone like James Corbett on the show before. Not to say that he couldn't or any of that, but it probably just wasn't really in the purview in a way. So there are sometimes things where I have to kind of maybe, you know, bite my tongue, because ultimately it's, and I have to realize it's like, this isn't Media Monarchy. This is Ground Zero.
Damn it. Do you believe in Bigfoot? That's what I'm asking.
No, I don't really. I mean, I don't really believe in aliens either.
You don't believe in aliens. You don't see, like, do you think that there is some kind of programming going on as far as aliens? I mean, there's this classic conspiracy theorist thing that said that they were going to make us scared of terrorists, and then after terrorists, they were going.
That's the Wernher von Braun thing. Yeah, that the last card. We had one of our episodes last week was called The Last Card of Ground Zero.
Perfect. So I
think with a lot of things, I don't discount it. I don't deny it, but I haven't seen it. So I think that's also, I mean, with a lot of stuff where I have to kind of come down and say, I mean, most of the videos or the this and the that, you know, I don't really buy. But definitely there are crazy things and crazy lights and crazy sights that people have seen throughout the ages. And obviously something is, you know, at work there. I don't know what it is. That's ultimately, I think, the smartest thing you can say is you don't know.
What about synchronicity, though? I mean, so as someone playing with media and music, sometimes you make connections unconsciously, or they just happen, and all of a sudden you come up with something better through this lateral connection.
That, I guess I've just always tried to, I don't know, maybe in a way I've just always tried to share the synchronicities without trying to necessarily figure out why it's happening or who's maybe making it happen. I think ultimately the human mind is a very powerful, powerful thing.
See, you know,
and so we want to put meaning to everything that happens and therefore create a narrative behind whatever it is that we're connecting.
And whether that narrative is, you know, a boogeyman that's going to get you, or an invisible savior who's going to save you, or yeah, I think we kind of have to ascribe. And man, I had a religious upbringing. I grew up in the church. A lot of that kind of probably, you know, screwed with my head as far as thinking about what will come in the future, because I grew up hearing Jack Van Impe talk about nuclear war with Russia is about to happen. You know, right. Growing up as a kid, you know, in a Baptist church in the early 80s in West Virginia and Red Dawn and all that kind of stuff, you know, you thought it was going to be the end then. Now, you know, 30 years later, you look and you're like, oh, they're still talking Armageddon. Look, there's a different version of Red Dawn out again. I think the programming is something there that wants to make us afraid and makes us, you know, to make us want to hide. And so when things like what happened in Connecticut happen, I think it serves to make us all crazier and we all kind of fixate on it. Because you can basically, and I looked it up just to kind of double check, that it's like, okay, yeah, essentially 3,200 people die every day in the world because of car wrecks.
Right. And a lot of them are children.
And a lot of them are children. And so you have to kind of question when these big shooter events happen, that there is something larger at play. There is a larger agenda at play. And whether that's just straight up gun control, when that has to do with, you know, United Nations and treaties, and whether Obama's behind it or any of that, I think, you know, keeps us all on edge. And that's what it's meant to do. Like Michael Tessarian always said, you know, it's ultimately a war on consciousness. And the more you let, you know, media dictate your emotions to you, you know, the more you're going to fall sway to these things. And you can just look on Facebook and see, you know, what your friends are saying after Connecticut. And you see, you know, surely you probably have people that, you know,
oh yeah,
signing, you know, petitions and da 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 da. So I think we're just kind of so manipulated, I guess. But who's behind it ultimately? You know, it seems like it's basically these long-term inbred elite families who have hidden knowledge away, and they've kind of hidden it away so they know how to make stuff happen, and we're always starting over like every day is the first.
Do you feel that there's a certain amount of destiny in you doing what you do?
I don't see myself being able to do anything else. This has always been the most natural thing for me. And it's only been because the technology has enabled it that's made it, you know, that much better in a way and make it that much more fun. I was always the guy that my friends would call up and go, hey, who's the guy that's in, you know, the movie? Or the internet. I was the nerd that my friends would call up to ask about, you know, some...
The second guitarist in Judas Priest is...
Now, I definitely have my certain areas of better experience than others.
Than Judas Priest.
Probably not be one of them, but you know, quote unquote, you know, alternative rock, you know, from the late 70s on, I could, you know, discuss at length. Or
but there's a lot of weird stuff going on in that too. One of the shows that I have injected into the Sync community, or one of the shows that you did, I think it was with Peter Lavenda. Did you ever interview Peter Lavenda?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites and one of my best, I think.
That's the one where you guys talk about the Kennedys, right? And how the Roman Polanski relationship?
That whole interview, and Peter Lavenda was already someone whose work I had admired. But essentially, and I think I kind of write this in the show notes, that in the course of a week, and this has been a couple of years ago, or a few years ago now, in the course of the same week, Susan Atkins, one of the Manson family convicted killers, died in prison. There was incest accusations that came out around the Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas. Mackenzie Phillips, I think, said that John Phillips had molested her, you know, or incest or something.
Oh, wow.
And that was the week that Roman Polanski got picked up in Switzerland, and that whole case kind of came back again. And just all of those things, when I saw those, it was like, those things are all kind of connected. And seeing them all in the news in the same week is really bizarre. And I immediately wrote Peter Lavenda. It's one of those like, hey, just take the dice, you know, roll the dice and email somebody. I emailed Peter Lavenda and was like, dude, all these three things happening. And I, you know, I have well-worn copies of his book, Sinister Forces, which gets into all of these things. Right. So he came on and we kind of talked about the Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy more so, and Polanski and the Manson family murders and all of those things.
Well, that's 42 minutes.
Awesome. Douglas?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Good night.
All right.
Bye-bye.